back together again, you and I chatting it up Tuesday's style, March 17th, 2026, right here on Connecticut Today. We open the show centering around a proposed bill in Hartford that would promote so-called transparency in hiring and salary offers for certain size Connecticut businesses. Yankee Institute blogger Megan Portfolio also offered her take on the same bill. And the Connecticut Food Association had Wayne Pesch join the show to talk about another possible pending bill in Hartford that would place state-level regulations on the use of self-checkout stations in potentially hundreds of supermarkets around the state.
All right, so admit it, we've kind of all been there. The vast, vast majority of us have been there where we apply for that first job or that early job or maybe even a recent job. And as soon as we hear that, hey, I may have the job or I have an interview coming up or it's only, you know, it's only a formality, you say to yourself, yeah, but you're always thinking, right, how much do I ask for? Well, do you know what it pays? I kind of have a general idea. Well, just ask for this. Yeah, but if I ask for that and he or she only wants to pay that or this, am I screwing myself here? So whether it was our first job that was anything above minimum wage 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago or something now, the idea of that back and forth, the negotiation, which, you know, kind of invariably takes place between an employer and an employee, that may now have some government interference here in Connecticut. And we start with this today, and I think generally this is not fair. I don't know whether it's a bad idea, but I think it's inherently unfair to the employer. Now, this is being put up there in Hartford under the guise of, well, there's wage discrimination going on. Well, is there really wage discrimination? And I know we get hit with that annual fee. Well, you know, women only make 80-something cents or 90 cents on the dollar versus a dollar that a man makes. Well, yeah, that's true, but statistically it's deceiving. If you take a look at what woman A and man A for the same job make, it's virtually the same. It may be a penny or two off, but it's virtually even. So this notion that we hear all the time about, well, women are being so criminally underpaid these days. No, they're not. It's 2026. Are we perfect on that yet? No, probably not, but we're getting there. But you tell me, is this an overreach, especially if you have, in the past, or maybe you do, hire people? So the question starts today at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Should Connecticut employers have to publish salary ranges and benefits in all job postings and to applicants before any compensation talks? So in other words, there's a law being proposed in Hartford that would say that Connecticut employers cannot, for example, say salary negotiable. Or if they do say that, they have to say the salary is between X and Y. Well, if the salary is between X and Y, isn't the applicant always going to ask for why? And again, believe me, I think people should get paid absolutely as much as possible. But part of, a rite of passage in society is a discussion you have with employers, between employers and employees. Well, how much do you want for the job? Well, I want X, Y, and Z. Well, I can't pay you that. Well, I think you're discriminating against me. You see what I mean? Now, there has been no surprise here. Our friends at the Connecticut Business and Industry Association, they don't like this bill. They say that having to mandatorily disclose salaries in discussions with employers limit the ability of the employer to negotiate with the employee. Hey, it's a negotiation. I didn't hire you yet. You want this much money at the top of my salary range. Well, you're coming in here with no experience. I might pay somebody more if this is their third gig. 203-333-9422. I need more coffee. WICC, this is House Bill 5387. A bill aimed, it says here, at enhancing wage transparency. That's fancy political speak for, I've got to tell you what I'm thinking. It requires employers to disclose salary ranges and benefits in all postings and to applicants before compensation discussions. So you have to say what the salary range is before you decide on the salary range. Is that fair? I don't know. I probably wouldn't have made a good boss. Rich in Easton starts us off. Rich, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Good afternoon, Paul. Thank you for your time.
Yes, sir.
I've hired over 1,000 individuals.
Wow.
At least overseeing the hiring process.
Wow.
As an HR exec.
Yeah.
Let me tell you a few things. First, organizations typically do what they call banding, salary bands.
Yeah.
That band could be $20,000 to $40,000.
Exactly.
$40,000 to $60,000.
Exactly.
So it's not that clear. But the point I'm making is, one, an applicant should know their salary, or at least what they're worth competitively, whether they go to O-Net or salary.com, number one. Number two, organizations typically pay to the midpoint, which means the individual they believe is fully qualified. So you will pretty much know the midpoint if they're discussing that salary band. And, of course, credentialing, education, et cetera, exact experience tend to matter more if you go beyond that midpoint. But the competitive range, when I was a comp analyst for a number of years, typically it's around the midpoint, and the midpoint is the competitive salary based on the surveys we've done with other employers relative to that job.
Interesting, interesting. All right. So how does this, Rich, before we go to news here, how does this proposal hit you at first blush here? You think we need an actual law here, or is this a little bit of governmental overcreep? Because I've never hired anybody, so I don't know. You tell me.
I think it's a little overreach, because I think organizations should have the option of deciding, do they want to post their ranges? Do they want, and those ranges are broad?
Yeah.
I don't know that for you. I think it's a little bit of an overreach. If an organization is an employer of choice, and they're going to be very competitive, most likely, in attracting the right kind of applicant.
Sure, you can't pay. I've been told by people in your position, Rich, if you want good people, you can't pay garbage, right? Isn't that true?
Yeah, that's right.
All right.
And you have to know your own competitive salary ranges. And I did salary surveys for years to try to understand where that midpoint lies relative to credentials and education and specific experience to match the jobs. But we would always say that employers today want 11 out of 10.
Hey, Rich, thank you, sir. I appreciate the call. Good stuff there. I expected a professional would weigh in on this. But if you're a professional or not, or if you have thoughts on this, 203-333-9422, 333-WICC, House Bill 5387, being considered up in Hartford. Basically, it would mandate here that Connecticut employers would have to publish salary ranges and itemized benefit packages in all job postings and to applicants before any real talk of compensation. What do you think of that? Megan Portfolios here. Megan, good afternoon. How might you be today?
Hey, $6,000 is a lot in right now in Connecticut.
Yeah, but I mean, we're talking 1987, $6,000. So do the math. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You're a treasure, so you deserve every penny.
Oh, stop it. Oh, my God, you make me blush. So, hey, you wrote your column on this pay transparency bill, but your angle is different from the angle I've been talking about with private employers, what have you noticed, Ms. Portfolio, about this bill that people may go,
Well, this bill's been around, kicking around for a few years,
yeah.
And it's pushed mostly by the AFL-CIO. They're claiming that if employers don't post salary ranges, which I'm kind of torn with, I learned very early how to negotiate my salary.
Yeah.
So for someone like me, that's actually detrimental because I actually can get, you know, I can get more than,
you know,
that. I get it. If you're new to the workforce, you don't know. But we
sure.
we have this thing called the World Wide Web, so it's really easy to look up, like Glassdoor, Monster, all these ones to see what the...
Yeah.
That being said, so the AFL-CIO is saying that we need to force a private business to put salary ranges on their job posting because apparently there's this pay disparity between men and women.
Okay.
AFL-CIO is arguing that women get 81 cents for every dollar to men.
Yeah.
Okay, so we need to have salary transparency to help correct this.
Okay.
Well, one of their own affiliates has a job posting online right now.
Okay.
No salary range.
I'm shocked.
There's nothing on there. So what are you telling me, AFL-CIO? One of your own affiliates is paying women 81 cents on the dollar because they're not putting their salary range?
Have you gotten any nasty union email on this?
No, listen, the unions are very powerful in this
Absolutely.
State. I mean, I call them a fourth branch of government. They don't need to send me mean emails.
No.
They hold all the cards.
But you know, to your point, Megan, and check out Megan's column at the Yankee Institute, the Hartford Portfolio. Yeah, you're right. I mean, you sound very good at it. Now, in my earlier days in this business, now I'm approaching the age where I just don't care. If I have to live under a bridge, I will. I don't care. But my first few jobs, all right, Paul, let's talk about what we can pay you. I'll take anything. Now, see, I finally advanced past that. But man, those first couple of times, Megan, and I know you've worked in the private sector too, when we're asked that, it's like, what do I say? You know, it's tough.
Well, it's real, and the employers kind of have you when it's your first
job.
But you don't really have a lot to bring to the table other than, I mean, I had my high school diploma, but that's all I had. So it's like it's hard for me to barter with them because I don't really bring much to the table. You have to train me from scratch. Then once I got my feet wet, then I was put in a position like you did at your, you know, previous job in radio, where I was like, listen, your competitor, my competitor, they want to hire me for another 10 grand. Do you want me to stay or do you want me to leave?
What happened
when
with
you're
that?
In sales? Sales is a different world.
How'd that work out?
Oh, I got the money.
Nice. There you go.
But you have to have something to bring to the table. And not all employers leave that out. And especially at a lot of the positions at the lower rung, like the entry level positions, they will post that on there.
Yeah.
They will have on. So this isn't like all employers don't post this on there, but I think it puts a worker to a disadvantage in the negotiation because the employer is saying, okay, your salary is going to be 50 to 60,000. Well, I want 75,000 or I want 70. And this is what I can bring to the table.
Nice.
And this is why I deserve it. I think people are getting better at negotiating and I think women are getting better at it. You know, speaking from, you know, female perspective, you know, women in the 90s and early 2000s, we didn't ask for what we were worth.
Yeah.
And I think with, you know, social media and with just so much information out there, I think women are getting stronger and are able and do deserve to be paid equally. And I think that disparity that everyone talks about, I think that's pretty much closed at this point.
Yeah. In fact, I interviewed somebody on this not long ago, a couple of years back, and they said, and it was some female business analyst who said, listen, on surface, that 80% to a dollar man makes a man would make is statistically okay if you're looking at an average salary for every guy's job versus every woman's job, not taking into account that some women are working really low-paying jobs that men won't or wouldn't ever take. But the argument I've seen that it's actually not 80 cents, it's like 97 cents on the dollar, whatever, is that if you take, say, a valid comparison of like five female CFOs and five male CFOs in the same size company, it's actually a lot a lot narrower than the 20 cents.
If at all. I mean, honestly, if at all, especially in, you know, the age of woke, you know, it's kind of a, you know, you get a check mark for being female.
Yeah. There you go.
Especially if you're entering a male-dominated industry.
Can I try that?
You know, we all strive for diversity these days.
Can I have our HR people here at Connoisseur change my gender? I'm sorry, I wouldn't do that. Hey.
You never know nowadays. I don't want to assume.
Hey, before we let you go here, I know you've been eyeballing dozens of hours of CTN, reading bills and downloading them. Is there an alarm from Megan on anything this week, or how are we doing?
Yeah, actually there is. If I have like 2 seconds,
sure, take your time.
And it's kind of a really boring, obscure bill that most people wouldn't really know about. But we have this committee called the Rules and Regulations Committee.
Okay.
So any regulation that comes through that the state agencies put forth, they can't just invent things. It has to go through this committee to make sure it's all kosher.
Okay.
This committee back in 1971 was set up to be bipartisan, equal members from both parties.
Yeah.
So right now I think it's 7-7.
Okay.
They want to change that makeup. They want to make it so that the majority party has more seats at the table.
I'm shocked.
But here's the, problem.
Stunned.
And
yes.
I know it's super boring, but these are executive branch agencies.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we have, you know, the majority party's got the governorship.
Mm-hmm.
Now you have the majority party in the legislature. It kind of blurs the checks and balances line. So, I mean, it would make regulations basically just a rubber stamp for whoever the majority party is. And that's not the way that this system was set up. So I wrote about it today. You can check it out at yankeeinstitute.org. And it's Bill HB 5554. And I just checked it out. There's got to be like 100 testimonies. Everyone is opposed to it. There's not one in support.
Really? Is the opposition bipartisan?
You know, I'm trying to figure that out. I don't know, because in a short session, they have to be committee bills, so you don't really see a lot of the names of the sponsors in the beginning. So I'm trying to figure out, like, who the heck? I mean, I'm assuming it's the majority party, you know, doing a power grab.
Yeah.
But I don't have any evidence of that, because it just doesn't say it. It just says it's a committee bill at this point. But the public hearing's tomorrow, so I'm really excited to watch that.
Excellent.
But the Rules and Regulations Committee, they were the ones that put a stop to the gas car mandate. If that committee was not even, that would have passed, even though the majority of the state did not want that. And we have a regulation coming down the pike, and I mean, definitely any month now, with the regional greenhouse gas initiative.
Oh,
they want to increase that, which we would see on the supply side of our electric bill. Like, that would increase our electric bill.
Oh,
if this committee is imbalanced, there's a chance that could just be rubber stamped, and that's just not cool. And it wasn't the legislative intent.
Oh, my God. All right, folks, check all this out.
Sorry, I'm such a Debbie Downer during session. I'll have to find something nice to write about next week. But it's really hard this session.
YankeeInstitute.org, Megan Portfolio, the Hartford Portfolio, as she is on patrol for you and I. Megan, thanks. We'll chat next week. Thanks.
Bye, Paul.
No, bye-bye. All right, we talked about a bill a couple of weeks ago. And again, there's no guarantee that any of this is going to become law. But a lot of times you can just tell by some of these bills the general direction of a state. And there is a bill in the Senate right now, Senate Bill 438, that basically, if you look at it from 30,000 feet up, like they say, it allows the state to kind of Bigfoot and tell companies, grocery businesses, big and small, how to use, regulate, and staff self-checkouts. Like we have nothing else to worry about in this state. Electric bills? We don't need to worry about that. Infrastructure? No, don't have to worry about that. Kids graduating who can't read? No, forget about that. We have to worry about self-checkouts. All right, good op-ed distilling this in the latest Hartford Business Journal. Connecticut does not need government to run the grocery checkout line. No, it doesn't. My opinion, anyway, the opinion of our next guest. We haven't had him on in a while, but our buddy Wayne Pesch from the Connecticut Food Association. Wayne, it's Paul. How are you, sir? It's been a while. How you been?
Hi, Paul. Happy St. Patrick's Day, my friend.
Yes, sir. You too, Wayne. So I read this bill. You know, somebody forwarded the outline of this bill to me and said, look at this. And I'm like, all right, I kind of understand what's going on here, but Wayne, you know more about this, outline, you know, the present policies of what many of these big grocers do, big and small, and what this bill would effectively make them do.
Well, look, first of all, this bill is being driven by the United Food and Commercial Workers Group, who claim that, you know, there has been a loss of jobs in the grocery industry and that they're trying to protect jobs and that they're trying to protect the state because the state is losing revenue because there's a lot of theft at the self-checkout. So they're protecting the state's resources. And also they're protecting minors because minors can potentially buy beer and tobacco products at these self-checkout areas of the store. And a lot of it, unfortunately, is misinformation. The fact is that any retailer today, so there's approximately 325 retailers using self-checkout in the state that serve millions of consumers a week. And so the claim that jobs have gone away because of the self-checkout registers, nobody lost a job in 2025 because of a self-checkout register. If anything, the jobs have shifted in these grocery stores. So, for example, 10 years ago, you didn't have the food-to-go selections and the people that are creating those products in the stores. You didn't have people doing pick-and-pay for curbside pickup. You didn't have people delivering groceries the way that they do. So the jobs have shifted, and consumers now have a choice. And 60% of those consumers actually prefer to go through self-checkout for speed and convenience. It's their choice. One of the other claims is that the grocers are limiting their labor by forcing people into self-checkout. And you know, again, disingenuous in terms of the argument, because people are choosing that on their own. I got two daughters that are Gen Xers, and when we go into the store, it's a joke because dad always wants to go. I want to go talk to a person at the register and get my stuff bagged. Right. I have that option.
Yeah.
But my kids are like, Dad, what are you doing? No, we go over here. We do it this way. So, you know, this idea that you know, retailers are forcing people into self-checkout to eliminate jobs, it's just not true. It's just the industry has shifted over the last two decades, and that's where we're going, and that's how we operate today.
And, Wayne, having back in my days when I was a street reporter, I remember covering a big strike. I think it was with Stop and Shop years ago. And I remember while we were waiting for the union votes and everything, and I don't know how it is today, but I remember talking to a couple of the union heads, and we were talking about this exact thing. And Wayne, correct me if I'm wrong, but people, he told me this, and people are under the impression that, you know, this the use of self-checkout is a one-way street. And I was always told by the union people, well, no, that's an already bargained for thing in our contract negotiations, where there is input already, I was told, from the union as to how many self-checkouts we'll have open in each store at each particular time. So, Wayne, I don't know. This is a union guy telling me this years ago. I don't think they're getting shut out here, are they?
Well, again, there are collective bargaining measures for unions to talk to those companies in regards of the negotiations on their contracts. But this idea that government is going to mandate how these businesses are operating, look, in terms of affordability and keeping costs down, the faster we get people through the store, the better off everybody is. And if you're going to do something like they're talking about here, which is mandate our labor resources, that's just, that doesn't make groceries more affordable. So you can't have it both ways. I'll give you another example.
Sure.
I'll give you a great example of why this doesn't work.
All right.
The last two major snowstorms, January and February, I think it was Fern and Umberto, okay? The stores, 24 to 36 hours leading up to those storms were just a cattle call.
I know.
It was a cattle call.
Yeah.
Right. But wait a minute. For the next 36 hours, there was nobody in the store.
Yeah.
So these businesses run on day part, on, yeah, on occasions, on holidays, on first of the month, on storms. And this idea that, you know, us having to mandate how we allocate our labor resources, it is going to drive up costs eventually. And guess what? Guess who pays that?
Yeah, absolutely. Wayne,
the consumer.
Sure. And Wayne, listen, look, you're not going to name names or whatever, but what are you hearing? Does this thing actually, and I know we're in the short session up at the Esteem Capital, does this thing actually have a chance, do you think? Or is this kind of an election year piece of candy? Hey, we're thinking of you. This has no shot, but we'll try it anyway. Have you heard anything? What do you hear?
Well, here's my opinion. First of all, this is not even candy for the masses. This is candy for special interests. Mm-hmm. So, you know, consumers, if they, you know, anybody listening to this or anybody who gets the facts would be like, okay, why are we going to tell them how to run their business if it's going to drive our costs up? Yeah. I personally believe they pushed through a warehouse workers bill.
Yeah.
Through what was called an ESERT bill,
yep,
which was a big priority for the labor folks. And their other big priority is striking workers, which the governor vetoed last year. But that bill is still working its way through the House. The House and the Senate. I don't think that this is particularly on the top of mm-hmm. their priority list.
Mm-hmm.
But just the idea of it gets my blood boiling,
yeah,
right? It's like, why are we talking about this? Why aren't we talking about things that make life more affordable?
Electric
in our
bills. How about the electric bills, Wayne? Why don't we do that?
Well, how about insurance costs?
Yeah.
We're the insurance capital of the world.
Yeah.
You know, how about fuel taxes? You know, there are. I just posted something today on our Connecticut Food Association site about where people move to
mm-hmm.
in 2025. And the interesting thing is Connecticut actually held its own, losing only about 8% of our population compared to New York.
All right.
And Massachusetts, which got hit even harder. So I'm going to give the governor, you know, some credit in terms of holding the line on some of this silliness. I don't think the governor's office supports any of this stuff. I haven't talked to them personally, but I don't believe that they do.
Mm-hmm.
This is coming from a certain segment in the legislature who can't get enough.
Yeah.
And who, you know, these are the same people who are bringing up a sugar tax and are going to, they're going to hurt businesses they're going to kill business on the border. They're going to hurt jobs, but it's okay because we're going to save a few people.
Yes.
And there goes the moving truck.
There it is.
I live here. I'm not moving. I'm going to stay and fight. I live in this state. I grew up in this state. I'm a lifelong resident. I'm going to retire here. So there are certain things that when they start pushing the buttons on
yeah.
it, whether they're going to go or not, you know, guys like you in the media and guys like me who represent, you know, certain business interests, that we want people to stay here.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And it's got to be affordable for people to live here. So, you know, this just makes things more unaffordable. And these are the same people, many of them, that are talking about affordability.
Absolutely.
Well, okay. Well, it's not affordable.
The Connecticut Food Association, check it out online. It's ctfoodassociation.org, ctfoodassociation.org. Wayne Pesch has been the guest. Wayne, as always, thanks, my friend. Appreciate it. We'll talk down the road, I'm sure. Thanks, Wayne.
Thank you so much, Paul.
I appreciate it. Wayne Pesch, PESCE, the Connecticut Food Association.